Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Gonna lay down my sword and shield down by the riverside. Down by the riverside. Down by the riverside. Gonna lay down my sword and shield down by the riverside. Study war.
Is war inevitable? Mahalia Jackson, is war inevitable? Everyone, to begin our Memorial Day program today, we will re-air an interview we did recently with John Horgan. It began our series, End of War, inspired by the U.S. withdrawal from Iraq and this new book by science journalist John Horgan. The end of our involvement in Iraq, after 100,000 people died, got us asking, do human beings really have to do this over and over again? The book is called The End of War, and call him naive, but after years of studying war a lot more, Horgan has come to the conclusion that war is not inevitable and not part of human nature. John Horgan joins us now. John, thanks for a very thought-provoking book, and welcome to WNYC.
And John, let's get to know you just a little bit. You direct the Center for Science Writing at the Stevens Institute of Technology in Hoboken. You've written regularly for Scientific American. And you have some previous books, including The End of Science, published in the 90s, and Rational Mysticism from 2003. And you've spent a lot of time going around asking people whether they think war is inevitable?
That's right. The reason that I decided to write this book is because for the past 7 or 8 years, I have been surveying people on this question of whether you think war will ever end. The first time I did it was when I was giving a talk at a church in my hometown. The priest had asked me to talk to his parish about something related to warfare, and I decided to address the question of whether war is in our genes, and I reviewed some of the literature on that. And then I tried to have this optimistic ending to the talk and said something like, maybe there is some kind of biological predisposition in humans that makes them fight, but we can overcome it and we can achieve peace once and for all. And then everybody was kind of looking at me skeptically. So I asked them point blank, how many of you think war can end one day? And virtually no one raised their hands. And I was really distressed by that because these were good liberal doves. And so I have been surveying people ever since then. I've been surveying my students, people in Europe, old, young, left, right. Overwhelmingly, people are very pessimistic about the prospects for ending war. They think of war as this permanent part of the human condition. And so I set out to write a book that would challenge that fatalism.
How many people do you think you've asked the question of total?
Oh, thousands by now. Just at my school, it's probably at least 1,000 students. And hundreds more people, as I said, in Europe. Every time I have a captive audience, basically, I ask people this question. And so, as I said, the results are fairly consistent. And in my book, I try to present evidence that counters this fatalism. For example, a lot of people are fatalistic because they think that war is part of human nature. As long as there have been humans, and maybe even longer, we have been engaging in group violence against each other. This has become a very popular scientific theory these days. There's some scientists who think that war goes all the way back to the common ancestor with chimpanzees, which would mean that we've been fighting for millions of years.
And I know you don't believe that, and we're going to get into that. And I think your theory on why not to look at the chimpanzees and say that they are determinant of what we do is really interesting. So we're going to get into that. We're going to get into what happened before agriculture. But let's just hear what some of our listeners are saying. George in Manhattan, is war inevitable?
Yes, war is inevitable.
Why?
Because as long as corporations are treated as individuals and people can contribute as corporations as much money as they can to political decisions, politicians are going to listen to their the corporations, because the corporations are promising jobs.
Who are
going to
have more of it?
their jobs.
Interest in war.
War equal jobs.
Equal war, jobs equal war. Citizens United promotes war, says George in Manhattan, to start us off. Patrick on Long Island, is war inevitable?
It's not inevitable if we do the right things to prevent it. I think people have to be educated to understand what war achieves and what it doesn't achieve. And if people aren't educated, we're doomed to keep perpetuating it.
Thank you. Mark in Brooklyn, is war inevitable?
I'd say it is. I was convinced by the line from Cormac McCarthy in Blood Meridian that before there was man, there was war waiting for it, its ultimate practitioner.
Thank you. Kathy in West Islip, is war inevitable?
Yeah, I think it probably is. I think there's a potentiality if you look at our closest relatives, common chimps and bonobos, for two different ways to deal with conflict. Bonobos are, of course, the peaceful, sexy ones, and common chimps are the ones that, not only have war, but there's also cannibalism amongst them. So, and I think that we're as closely related to one as the other, so I think the potentiality is always there. So I'm afraid... and it's common for humans, as it is for common chimps, to band together as male groups that then go out and wage war. I think the thing that changes it is among bonobos, it's a female-dominated society, and I'm not sure we'll ever get there.
We are definitely going to come back to that idea of men and women and bonobos with John Horgan as we continue here. Harry in Queens, is war inevitable?
I think war is not inevitable. I think there could be an end to it. I think if we empower local people through greenhouses and sustainability and local vineyards, we would be able to end the conflict between men.
Eat local, locavore equals peace. Joel in Irvington, is war inevitable?
Oh, definitely. As much as we choose to deny and forget it, we are primates. We're more closely related to chimpanzees than chimpanzees are to gorillas. We're devoted at the deepest level to our family, clan, or troop mates. We're fiercely protective against those of other groups. But as humans, our downfall is that other is no longer simply defined by smell or territory. We are capable of symbolic thought, and that makes us able to define other by anything, labels, religious, national, or so on, skin color, school of thought, until we figure out how to deal with this ethological curse. We won't have wars.
Joel, thank you very much. All right, that was a little sampling, and we could go on taking calls, and we will. But John Horgan, I was struck by how many people referenced the chimpanzees. Maybe this is what you found with your thousands of interviews asking the same questions?
Yeah. So this is a theory that is associated especially with an anthropologist at Harvard named Richard Wrangham. He and others, beginning in the mid-1970s, have observed bands of chimpanzees coming together and attacking chimps from another troop. And yes, chimpanzees are our closest genetic relatives, so this is very disturbing. Here are some counterfacts. First of all, Jane Goodall was watching chimpanzees for 15 years without ever seeing one of these cases of group against group violence. When it started emerging, Goodall herself thought that it might be because she had put bananas out to attract chimpanzees to her observing stations. There are scholars who think that this might be a behavior that's related to some of the unusual conditions at some of these reservations, plus human encroachment on chimpanzee habitat. Even so, these raids are extremely rare. According to one estimate, an anthropologist would have to watch a typical chimpanzee troop for 7 years before seeing one of these incidents. There are some communities that have never been seen engaging in this kind of behavior. A listener mentioned the bonobos, another chimpanzee species that has never been observed seeing this behavior. I think a more important fact to keep in mind is that evidence of human warfare, human group against group violence.
Before we even get to that, just before we get off the chimps and the bonobos, your point in the book, if I read it correctly, is that we are as close cousins with the bonobos as we are of the chimps.
That's right.
And so if one of those groups seems to have intergroup violence in their DNA and the other one doesn't, who's to say we are determined by evolution to be like the chimps.
That's right. So there's another anthropologist, he's sort of the counter Richard Wrangham, named Franz de Waal, who is at Emory University, and he has studied the bonobos, and he's made the point that it's pretty much arbitrary whether you choose to see bonobos or the more common chimpanzee species as a kind of model for human behavior and especially aggressive behavior. And so in that case, I think it's important to look at the evidence from human archaeology and anthropology. And there I think that the evidence points clearly to the conclusion that war is a quite recent behavior. It doesn't go back hundreds of thousands, let alone millions of years. It really only started emerging 10 to 12,000 years ago, especially first in Mesopotamia, in Asia, and the Middle East, and then rapidly did spread around the world.
They're having a war in Mesopotamia right
now.
That's
right.
though the U.S. is pulling its troops out of there. But are you tying this to humans settling down from the hunter-gatherer era to start agriculture?
So there's been this debate in anthropology that goes back decades over whether hunter-gatherers engaged in war. And it's an important question because humans lived as hunter-gatherers for most of our existence, going back to the beginning of the Homo genus about 2 million years ago. The evidence is conclusive. Hunter-gatherers do engage in war, but they only started very recently.
And listeners, this series is interactive, and you can check out other interviews and videos and audio clips of some of our recent guests talking about whether they think war is inevitable. Go to wnyc.org/endofwar. We're collecting your responses, too, so you can find our survey there. Go to wnyc.org/endofwar. And we have to take a break in a minute, John, but before we do, I want to close the thought from the caller who brought up the bonobos or bonobos, I don't know which is the right way to say it, that this is a female-dominated society. And this is another idea that comes up time and time again, which is that one of the conditions that probably needs to be met if humans are ever to put an end to war, and I tend to think this myself, is that women would have to have 50% of all the seats of power in government, because look at any schoolyard, look at any prisoner for violent crime population, and the stats on that.
That's right. According to one estimate, more than 99% of the combatants throughout history have been male. I think it's fair to say when you look at rates of violent crime and the pattern of warfare through history that males are innately more aggressive than females. I think that female empowerment can reduce the risk of violence in any society. On the other hand, I want to get away from the idea that there are certain things that you must do to create a peaceful society, like giving women equal power to men.
Or them taking it for themselves, but go ahead.
That's right, or creating or eliminating all poverty or creating some kind of socialist utopia. Or, you know, there are all these sort of solutions to war. And the problem is, for example, in female empowerment, we have a century of growing female rights in this country, in the United States, and yet we've remained extremely militaristic. So there are no silver bullets. I think female empowerment is something that's extremely important to pursue for its own sake, and especially in certain developing nations, there's a correlation between female empowerment and lower birth rates, which puts less strain on resources in those countries and has a whole cascade of positive effects. But one of the conclusions I came to in my book is that war is this kind of independent variable that can perpetuate itself apart from all these other things that people traditionally have thought could be done to reduce the risk of violence. And so we need to address war as a problem in itself.
Listeners, we continue with John Horgan, author of the new book, The End of War. Now, you've just heard John say some of the places that he thinks war does not come from. Evolution, gender, poverty, industry. We'll hear some of the places that he thinks war does come from when we come back and why he thinks that makes the end of war possible. Stay with us. Mm-hmm.
Gonna lay down my sword and shield down by the riverside, down by the riverside, down by the riverside. Gonna lay down my sword and shield down by the riverside. Study war no more.
Marianne in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Is war inevitable?
My first thought is that if we really were to take on all the behaviors of the chimpanzees, we'd all be throwing poop at each other, too, and that's not happening. But
I don't know what neighborhood you live in.
If we could somehow equate war rather than a symbol of power, but as a last resort type situation that only the weakest of states have to resort to engaging in war, then it would be seen almost as a shameful sign of weakness. And the other thought is if perhaps it was mandatory that every time we went into war that anyone in Congress who had a daughter or son would be forced to it'd be an obligation to send that daughter or son onto the front lines. I think that might do a lot to curb aggression.
Thank you very much. Irene in Oakland, is war inevitable?
Well, it seems in recent times the United States has become a world-class war maker. And we have long wars and short wars, all kinds of different wars in the name of freedom or democracy. And when somebody like Ron Paul stands up and says, gee, we should maybe talk to these people first, he's booed. And he's considered unpatriotic somehow. So the thinking is, unless we're willing to go smoke them out and kill them and get them in the name of something like freedom or democracy or saving some people.
So does this make you think that war is inevitable because of that kind of reaction to Ron Paul?
Yes. If you look at the recent times in this country, yes. And I also think it's cyclical. Then you may have a peaceful time, but somehow people decide they have to get the other guy, and it becomes the right thing to do. Go
Irene,
and kill them.
Thank you very much. Charlotte in Sunset Park, is war inevitable?
I don't think it is. I think it has been, you know, I only recently started to think that it wasn't inevitable because I see more and more information or data on how sociability and cooperation. I'm just getting all of these signs that as a planet, as a globe, we're kind of recognizing that in order to survive, we have to cooperate. And it may be just something that I pick up on because I'm interested in it, but I feel like there is this trend towards understanding on an evolutionary perspective that we've been suppressing this real strong evolutionary urge to, or human urge to cooperate, to empathize, to, you know, we're social creatures. So I think if we want to survive, we have to adapt now for cooperation. And we are, you know, we do want to survive. So, you know, that's what we've been doing for, you know, several million years. So I don't think it is inevitable anymore.
Charlotte, thank you very much. John Horgan, my guest, author of The End of War. Now, that is so interesting that Charlotte turns the evolutionary argument on its head and says, well, maybe we evolved to have war, but now that there's nuclear weapons and society can annihilate itself if we continue to be warlike, then we're probably going to evolve in the literal scientific sense to be more cooperative because the survival of the species depends on it. But do you buy – I mean, evolution, real evolution takes many, 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 many generations.
I don't think we are innate pacifists any more than we are innate warriors. But I mentioned Franz de Waal before. He is an anthropologist who, along with many others, has pointed out that we do have biological impulses toward cooperation, toward altruism, at least towards others in our in-group. One of the reasons why I'm optimistic at this particular point in history is because there are some cultural trends that I think are really pointing in the right direction. A really powerful one is the spread of democracy. So a century ago, only about 10% of humanity lived under democracy. Today, depending on how you count it, it might be about two-thirds of the human population. And there is a finding in political science that suggests that democracies just don't wage war against each other, or they are much less likely to. Another positive trend, I think, is the emergence of media, which points out the horrors of war more than ever before. I do think that female empowerment, which we were discussing earlier, is another positive trend. So all these different things are converging, I think, to bring us to the point where we can talk about renouncing war once and for all.
And yet you also deal in the book with what you call the 2% theory, which is that even if 98% of human beings are peaceful, it's only going to take that 2% to be – I'm trying to put this in exactly the right way. Those 2% might be the same people who are thirsty for power. So the same people who are more likely to get into heads of state kinds of positions, even in democracy, and therefore be more likely to be, you know, a kind of us against them mind frame kind of person. And so the 2% may be all that we need in order to be doomed to perpetual war.
It's a scary theory. It's sort of a subset of the more general biological theory, which says that all men are innately violent and warlike. So this is a theory that says there's this small, very small percentage of men that have these tendencies. And there's suggestive research on this, which says that, for example, about anywhere from 1% to 3% of the population is sociopathic. These are people who lack empathy toward others, and so they are the ones who perpetuate war and other extreme kinds of violence, genocide and so forth. The problem with that is it just doesn't hold up to scrutiny very well. When you look at World War II, World War I, you know, these massive outbreaks of violence, it's not just a small percentage of people who are carrying out the violence. It is entire populations. And I think the best explanation is that war itself, once it breaks out, makes people behave like sociopaths. Ascribing war and these kinds of extreme acts of violence to bad barrels instead of a small class of bad apples.
Vince, in Leonia, is war inevitable?
I think what is inevitable, Brian, is that we will always confront confrontation and disharmony among one another. But I don't think it's inevitable that we have to react in a warlike fashion. So what I'm saying is that we must anticipate disruptive behavior, rather conflicts, etc. Conflict is always going to be part of our nature. But our resolution to conflict is increasingly, I think, moving, as he suggests, towards a human race that's more empathetic and more compassionate in a qualitatively different way than the preceding parts of our evolution have.
Thank you very much. By the way, you mentioned Europe and the wars. And I haven't seen this in the book yet. I haven't read every page yet, though I intend to. But I put in my video that Western Europe is one of the strongest arguments, in my opinion, for the possibility of ending war, even though I remain skeptical, because of what's happened since World War II. Right. Here's a part of the world that was constantly or on again, off again at war. Whether in, you know, tribes, pre-nations or nations, for 1,000 years and more.
Right.
And they seem to have put an end to war after World War II for that region. They have a little softer notion of sovereignty now than they used to. Maybe the euro wasn't such a great idea, but they still have a softer notion of sovereignty. And instead of us looking down our noses at the warring Europeans, as we did before entering World War I and World War II, they're now looking down their noses at us as the warlike ones. We don't know if it will last, but at least here is part of a continent that is trying on for size an identity that we are past war.
Right. You know, what I look for are proofs of principle, just examples out there that show that that people can go from a state of extreme violence to peacefulness very rapidly. The European Union is a great example of that. There are individual nations, Sweden and Switzerland, in the 18th century were extremely militaristic and violent. They renounced militarism in the early 19th century. They have remained neutral, stayed out of wars ever since. A wonderful example that I like to cite is Costa Rica, which in the 1940s went through a terrible civil war. And it emerged from that, and collectively Costa Ricans decided, you know what, having an army seems to do us more harm than good. Let's just get rid of it and take those resources and invest them elsewhere. And
there they are, living in the middle of Nicaragua and the Sandinistas and El Salvador and their rightists and all of the whole thing.
That's right.
And they abolished their army.
That's right. So that shows to me that not only that war can end sort of in theory, but in practice, and it can end very, very rapidly. I see other examples just in the end of the Cold War. Who would have thought in 1980, 1985, that you could have a largely nonviolent end to the standoff between the U.S. and the Soviet Union, what the greatest totalitarian state in history, basically renouncing its power nonviolently, the end of apartheid. There are all these positive examples out there. You know, another one, Brian, is New York City itself. So I have a classroom that I teach at my school at Stevens, and my students, I bring up the question, do you think war will ever end? And they're always so pessimistic, and they say war will never end as long as some people have more than others, as long as we differ in religion and ethnic group and so forth. And I point out the window toward the skyline of New York City and say, that contradicts what you're saying. There's this enormously diverse group of people, diverse economically, ethnically, in every possible way.
Nobody's a majority in New York City.
That's right. And, you know, they argue, they squabble all the time, but largely nonviolently. People aren't carrying out suicide bombings against each other. So that's the kind of proof of principle that I'm looking for.
Robbie, in the aforementioned New York City, is war inevitable? Whoops. Robbie, I'm sorry. Robbie, now we have you, Robbie. I'm sorry.
Yes. Yeah, okay. Yes, it is inevitable. Do you remember the book African Genesis? The author wrote it, Robert Audrey, I think was his name. Mm-hmm. Audrey wrote it he had traveled with the Leakleys and Kappa in Africa. We are descended from killer apes. The territorial imperative is powerful within us. All you have to do is take 2 10-month-old babies, put them on the floor with some toys. They can't say, that's mine, that's mine. They will fight over what's mine. They will bop each other over the head with the nearest thing to protect their territory. Empathy is not inborn. We must quell our inborn aggressive nature by teaching empathy. And I remember that African Genesis ended by saying that, and at that time, there were only about 3 billion people on the globe. I guess we have 6 billion now. That the remarkable thing was that despite the petty humiliation, one-upping someone at the cocktail party, taking something from your neighbor, killing somebody nearby, that it was remarkable that there were enough people on the globe who were still stopping for red lights and not killing each other.
So you're not convinced by all this that you've heard
from John Horgan.
No,
it's our nature. The territorial imperative, the power to protect our turf and control it and take other people in to help us control it, that's what makes
big ones. Thank you very much. You mentioned the 10-month-olds. Makes me think of Lord of the Flies with adolescence. Of course, that's a novel. It is fiction, but it's supposed to be reflective of human nature. So, John, you don't believe that scarcity leads to war, that people go to war when their societies are running out of food or oil, because you can find societies that didn't. But you do believe that fear of scarcity sometimes leads to war. And you cite examples including Japan's brutal dominance of Asia in the 1930s and the first Gulf War involving the U.S. and Iraq in 1991. Do you want to take the U.S. example because it's more familiar? And is it an important idea for you of what actually does lead to war, fear in general or fear of scarcity as opposed to actual scarcity?
Yeah. So as you said, just empirically, when you look at the history of warfare and when you look at tribal societies, it is not the case that resource scarcity, especially combined with a growing population, leads inevitably to conflict. There are many societies where abundance seems to make conflict more likely. And of course, there's this terrible irony in the fact that when fear of resource scarcity does lead certain nations to fight against others over oil, let's say, or access to open water, that then you get resource scarcity as a consequence of fighting. I think leaders are actually beginning to learn that lesson. Here's how optimistic I am. I think that the American public and American leaders look at what has happened to the U.S. in Iraq and Afghanistan. They see the terrible economic consequences of our actions, and they're beginning to realize that wars really don't serve a rational strategic purpose, that they end up causing more harm than good, and not morally, but just in terms of our strategic objectives.
Do you have like a 5-point plan for ending war?
Well, the United States, I'd have to say, is a big problem. I am very optimistic right now when I look into the future. On the other hand, I live in a country that has a gigantic, swollen military, is pursuing still war in Afghanistan.
More military spending than every other country on Earth combined.
Yes.
We have 52%.
That's right, which is extraordinary. So, we're prepared to fight the rest of the world all at the same time. We're carrying out drone strikes around the world, basically just if we feel like it. So that also is very disturbing. I think now is the time for an American leader, I'm still hopeful that Obama could do this, to really take the initiative to spell out a plan for helping all nations achieve some kind of state of world peace. We have to show leadership in what we do, not just through rhetoric.
But I'm skeptical of the superpower theory of why there is war. I know the U.S. is the 800-pound gorilla in the world right now, but you have in your own book how in pre-Columbian times on this continent, the Pueblo Indians were peaceful. The Plains Indians would attack people just because that's what they did.
Right. Here's the theory of war that I end up supporting after looking at all the literature is one that goes back to Margaret Mead, the great anthropologist.
She's the hero of your book.
She really is. And she's disparaged very unfairly by a lot of modern scientists. She pointed out that war can emerge for many, many different reasons in any society, including the simplest, and then it becomes this self-perpetuating set of beliefs and behaviors. Fear of war, once war breaks out in a region, perpetuates war. Revenge perpetuates it.
Well, thank you, John Horgan, head of the Center for Science Writing at the Stevens Institute of Technology in Hoboken, for inspiring the series with your brand new book, The End of War. Thank you.
It's been my pleasure.
And coming up next on The Brian Lehrer Show, Julia Alvarez describes trips she has made to Haiti from her home in the Dominican Republic. Complicated relationship between people on the two sides of that island. Stay with us.